Okay, so we're all here and we all have coffee. So welcome to Radical Parenting, Raising Kids and Creating Community. So what we're going to do is kind of panel of the four of us and then go into some questions and answers and maybe some brainstorming if we have some time. So like it says in this guide, we're going to discuss parenting and creating community from a radical activist perspective, including the need for parenting allies and the importance of diversity to combat mainstream images and values towards parenting. So to that end, we have Tomas, Vicky, Matt, and me. I'm Jen. And in today's order, Tomas is going to speak first. He's talking about the daily practices of radical parenting and the need for allies.
Okay. Yeah, kind of. I'm just talking. Well, I started, well, I have three children, 19, 14, and 12, and it was nice to come out here and to actually stay with my son who lives in Brooklyn, which is the strangest experience in the world.
Should I do the sheets? Help pay for laundry.
I'm here on clean sheets. And so I started Rad Dad Zine kind of probably about 6 years ago. It came out of a bunch of other zines I was doing, partly because I noticed that as my children got older, when you have young children, you tend to fall into kind of instant community in a certain way. If you're at parks, if you're at libraries, you kind of are forced to mingle, to talk, to know other parents, and kid noise, they're totally fine. So once they started getting a little bit older and I started coming into, I became to feel more isolated in my community, even though partly from the radical community in the Bay Area. There wasn't a lot of children around, and this was like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there's more now. So I kind of fell out of that community, and then also once they start going into institutional schools, you start like separating along those kind of lines. And so for me, I really began to feel like there wasn't a lot of discussion going on. Also, particularly in relation to fathers, there was a lot of really wonderful mama zines. Hit mom was obviously one. The Future Generation, though she doesn't like to call it a parenting zine, it's just kind of a zine, but it was really inspirational because she has a child that's a few years older than mine, and to hear her talk about her child transitioning from kind of a young child to adolescent to a teenager was one of the only kind of stories that was out there, kind of sharing what it was like and the struggles. So as my son became older, became more autonomous, started dealing also with issues of drugs, dealing with the juvenile court system. There's just almost no support and conversation that's going on. And so that's kind of what spurred Rad Dad as a way to, like, there's got to be a larger community out there that I can kind of reach out to and hear what people are dealing with. And how do you talk about these issues in ways that aren't just kind of knee-jerk reactions, but kind of are incorporating radical politics and honesty, and yet also the kind of real life struggles of your kids in school, you've got to deal with that. There's kids dealing with like the court system, you've got to deal with that. And I don't quite know how to do that. You know, I know there's people who've experienced it before I have, and I would love to hear those kind of stories. So that's where it came from. And it really kind of worked. It was a really nice way to meet other parents out there that had gone through the same thing or that were in the process of going through the same thing so that I can also talk about my experiences. Because one of the things I realized, even as I sit at my table with the Rad Dad team, like if you've got kids between 2 and 4, you're considered a parent. And then I get a lot of parents who walk by like, oh, my child's older, so I have nothing really to offer. And I think that's a real loss of community, that kind of multi-generational things that can happen. And so I really encourage, I mean, now my child's 19, he doesn't even live with me anymore. So. But yet I still feel like it's really powerful to talk about these things and share those stories with other parents coming up right now. I have one other thing I forgot. I'm trying to figure out what I wanted to say. So anyways, we did it. It was really wonderful. So I'm living in California, and I was able to really, at the Anarchist Book Fair in California, which is a really big event, there was no child care for the first 6 years. And so I had to constantly have my kids with me. And at some point, I met a bunch of other parents, and we set up the Child Care Collective. And then after we did it for 2 years, we decided parents shouldn't have to be the only ones responsible for the Child Care Collective. So we decided we weren't going to do it 1 year. And sure enough, they kind of called us up and said, like, so what's the deal with the child care? Rahula, my friend Rahula, was like, I don't know, what's the deal with the child care here? And so it was really nice. As soon as we backed out, people stepped up. And there was this really amazing collective called UA in the Bay. And they, the last 3 years, have taken care of the child care space. And they made it, I feel bad because their space is so much better than what I had. Like I had like, it was really bad. And now I realized, wow, this is really amazing. So it was kind of nice to see all that support. And that's kind of where we're transitioning into those discussions about how people can support parents in kind of out of communities. And also, my final thing I wanted to say was that a lot of times parenting gets viewed as a particularly middle class and kind of white experience, but clearly it's not. And so I really wanted to create a space in my dad for fathers of color to write. Initially, though, that quickly changed as I had queer parents writing and trans parents kind of talking about what their experiences as parents were. So now the zine is kind of wide open, and I encourage anyone to take a look at it, to read it, to write for it, interview their parents, friends. One thing I learned in talking with a bunch of parent allies is that even if you don't have children, there's a role for you in the lives of children, and I think that was a really profound statement that I kind of realized. So with that, I have a table in that space over there. If I have any zines left, maybe they all get taken off the table. That'd be really great. Come by and stop by and see me. Thank you.
Who's next?
So hi, my name is Vicky, for those of you who don't know me, which I think is many people. And my experience, I have a 9-year-old daughter, and I sort of like came of age in the sort of anarchist Lower East Side squatting movement in the mid-90s and became a mom in 2000. And my experience was actually kind of different than Tomas's, because I found that when I became a mom, suddenly that community I had of like crazy anarchist squatters, you know, activists, disappeared. They were like, oh, you've got a kid. I guess you're not going to come around anymore. Guess we're not going to include you anymore. Too bad, so sad. You know, and I really had to struggle to sort of like find my new community and find a way to engage in the things that I felt were really meaningful and important. But also as somebody who had a small child, somebody who like couldn't necessarily like go running off to a demonstration where the police might beat people up, or there might be tear gas, or I might get arrested. You know, so I really had to struggle to find, you know, like a new community, and a new community that would allow me to express, like, my political involvement, as like, my politics, as well as just, like, the fact that I was a mother. So, like, I had these, like, two very separate, you know, populations in my life, like my former friends and activist colleagues, you know, who were like, ah, you know, we're all going to go up to, like, you know, like, this thing over here where we're all might get tear gassed and, you know, beat up. You know, sorry, can't come. Hey, we're going to go swap this abandoned building with tons of lead paint. Too bad you can't come, you know, kind of thing. And it's like, again and again, like, I found that kind of thing. And I was really frustrated. And slowly but surely, I started developing, like, a community of people that, you know, recognized that, like, you know, what I had to contribute was important. Like, I had years, you know, in the movement. Like, I had years of experience, you know, like, and also were willing to say, like, it's okay that you come with a baby that, you know, sometimes makes noise, sometimes pulls books off the shelf, sometimes, you know, is distracting, you know. Oh, and by the way, since you guys came in late, I wanted to say that kid noises are totally fine. Don't feel like you have to leave because, you know, your kid is making noise. Adult conversations, if your cell phone goes off, can you please take it outside, you know, just for everybody who came in late. But one of the things that, like, you know, so I really had to struggle to, like, sort of, like, find, like, new community, you know, like, so I met Jennifer that way, you know, like, sort of, like, as parents struggling to find, you know, community as politically engaged and politically involved parents that wanted to make a difference, you know, and in ways that weren't just necessarily, like, marginalized the parenting activities, like, you know, like, how could we do this? And what I found was that a lot of what I was able to do wouldn't have happened had I not had support from people who weren't parents, because when we rely on other parents and caretakers to support us, it's mutual aid, and we quickly get burnt out because we're all juggling, you know, parenting needs, childcare, you know, like the ability to somehow survive in society, you know, since, like, you know, since unfortunately we haven't reached this point where, like, everything is, like, mutually given, you know, and freely given. So with that in mind, I started looking at, like, you know, like, what other, you know, people, and especially mothers, were experiencing, you know, what other anarchists were experiencing, you know, like, once they became mothers. And I specifically focused on mothers because I found that my experience was also really gendered. Like, I have a male co-parent, and he was not expected to give up any of his stuff when, like, we became parents. You know, like, it was like, he could keep doing his thing, and I was expected to stay home and take care of the baby. And even the things that we participated in together, people would be like, oh, that's really sweet, that's really cute that you're involved in your boyfriend's project. And it's like, wait, I'm the one that's been involved in this project for years. How is it somehow my role is relegated to being, you know, to being like the supportive girlfriend, the supportive co-parent, the supportive partner, you know, versus like I'm being seen as like an equal participant in this. So I started looking at ways that other communities and other women were experiencing like motherhood, and I started doing a survey of mothers who explicitly identified as anarchists to see what their needs around community were and how they were or were not being met, you know, by people in their political communities. And, you know, I found some really interesting things that, like, you know, like the women who were able to stay involved were women who had support, you know, from not just their, like, immediate partners and family, but from their, like, you know, their larger community. So places that, like, were able to set up childcare for them or were able to understand that, like, children need space to make noise and to run around, you know, like, and that meetings couldn't be at the, like, late in, at the bar or at, like, the smoky tavern, you know, were the ones who were able to stay involved and to stay engaged in a meaningful way. And in 2008, I actually went to the Women's Encuentro in Chiapas, the Zapatista Women's Encuentro, and one of the things that amazed me was that there were children who were like 9, 10, 11, you know, who would actually get up and speak about what being part of the movement meant, you know, in terms of like having grown up in the movement. And one of the things that I saw was that people weren't sticking kids in like another room or like in the cornfield to say like, you know, like kids go there, you know, and all the political work happens here. You know, it's more that like kids would run in and out, they would like listen, they would learn, and then they would run out the door when they were like done being still. So like one of the things I realized was that like, you know, growing up in the movement, you know, meant that we were basically like having another generation coming up. Like we were expanding our movement by being kid-friendly, by accommodating the needs or, like, recognizing and accommodating the needs of the parents, you know, and the new parents and the caretakers in our movement. And one of the things I wanted to read to you was a quote, actually, from the Zapatistas about the fact that their movement has been growing, specifically because they have this tradition of incorporating their children into what they do, into their political struggles, into their dialogues and discussions. And if babies cry, and the children make noise, and this kid wants a hug, and this kid is hungry, you know, that's all fine. You know, we're not sort of like, oh no, that parent has to leave because their child is disrupted. So this is from their sixth declaration of the Selva Lacandona. But it is not just the Zapatista villages which have grown. The EZLN has also grown. Because what has happened during this time is that new generations have renewed our entire organization. And it also so happens that our insurgents, insurgentas, militants, local and regional responsables, as well as support bases, who were youngsters at the beginning of the uprising, are now mature men and women, combat veterans, and natural leaders in their units and communities. And those who were children in that January of 94, when the Zapatistas first rose up in the public eye, are now young people who have grown up in the resistance, and they have been trained in the rebel dignity lifted up by their elders throughout these 12 years of war. These young people have a political, technical, and cultural training that we, who began the Zapatista movement, did not have. This youth is now more and more sustaining our troops as well as leadership positions in the organization. And that's one of the amazing things that I saw about like how, you know, incorporating like, you know, like new generations into our political work like really has an impact. And then this past Saturday, I was at a performance and poetry reading called Roses and Bread, and I met two women in their 30s, maybe the other one's in her 30s, maybe she's in her 20s, Matt might know them, who basically grew up, you know, in these anti-imperialist groups that their parents were part of, and they grew up going to these meetings, and they grew up going to these discussions and these cultural events, and, you know, both of them remembered, you know, like, going to visit political prisoners as part of their childhood, and, you know, talking with them about, you know, their experiences and the fact that they were politically active and they took that political knowledge and experience into their adulthoods was amazing. It's like, wait, you know, like some of us like take years to kind of come to certain points of understanding and knowledge, you know, to get to this. And like basically the fact that there was a welcoming environment to raise children, you know, meant that these women came into this, you know, like and grew up in this, and this was like second nature to them. And I thought that was really great. So I wanted to sort of like end my little segment with a few examples of ways in which women who identified as anarchists and were mothers told me were ways that they had felt concretely supported. So I'm not just like throwing out this idea of like support that's kind of like general and vague, and people are like, I would like to support, you know, parents and caretakers and children and families, but I kind of don't know how. But ways in which they had actually felt supported and felt welcomed and were, you know, motivated to keep coming back to these groups and like these organizations and these programs that they were a part of. The first one, which, you know, Tomas covered already too, is don't rely on parents to organize childcare or to find their own childcare programs. Like, step up. Like, especially if you don't have, you know, your own children or small people or dependents, you know, like, you have more mobility and more ability to organize something than people who are constantly having to find childcare or wrangle childcare or balance, like, what they need versus what their kids need. And also, you can do things sort of like on the spur of the moment if you see that there is a need for childcare. One woman said that at a street corner protest action a few months ago, the attendees took turns engaging my son to keep him from being bored. One person who had driven a car had a park nearby and had a pillow and blanket in the back just for my son to lie down on when he got too cold and bored. So, like, this is, like, you know, like a very small way, but it's a very concrete way in which, you know, like, by engaging with the child, the mother was able to continue participating, and she didn't feel like she'd been shunned or excluded, and the kid wasn't sort of, like, dragged to something that was cold, you know, and boring and, like, unfulfilling that he would never want to go back to. Another thing is, if you see a child having a meltdown or a parent having a hard time, offer to help. Sometimes we don't want help, you know, you have to accept that, and sometimes you're like, can you just hold this baby for 2 minutes while I go pee, or, like, go outside and start screaming, or, you know, whatever. It could be a lifesaver, you know, and this is like a way in which you can just kind of concretely help, you know, like if you see that a kid is like, you know, bored, you know, like maybe offer to like draw or play tic-tac-toe with the kid, you know, like during the meeting. So it's not always again on the parent or caretaker to take the child out. Develop a relationship with the families, you know, in your communities or in your movements or in your scenes so that the children feel comfortable around you. So you're not sort of like that person out of left field that's like, let me take your 18-month-old out. And that 18-month-old is like, ah! And the parent is like, I don't know you, you know? But, like, develop relationships, you know? Be like, hey, we're going to do this. You know, like, this is a child-friendly thing that, you know, like, you can be, you know, you and your kid can come to. You know, like, I can make faces at this kid during the meeting. I can, you know, like, play the itsy-bitsy spider. And it's sort of like slowly developing relationships like you would in any other circumstance, except that maybe the person that you're developing a relationship with is years younger than you. You know, it's not, you know, it's not like a big scary thing that has to happen like right away. And finally, ask the families, you know, around you, and ask the parents and caretakers around you how you can be supportive. Because some people have like a lot of ideas like how support can be manifested that's the most helpful to them, you know. And what you might think might be supportive and helpful might not work for certain families and certain caretakers. So, you know, just ask. Be like, hey, how can we support you? And I'm sure that like you could get feedback, you know. And sometimes people will say, I don't know, and they'll come back with, you know, another answer later, and you also have to accept that.
Think about, no, but I'm on self-check here. Excuse my jumbled thoughts coming at a few different, and from a few different directions. I guess, first, I want to say I'm very thankful to be here and grateful, and I'm grateful in part because of the people in this room. A bunch of you I've never seen before, and that's exciting. I want to have time to meet you. And some of you I've met before and respect and love, and some of you I haven't met before, but I've like read about you and read your works and respect and love. I also want to introduce someone who came in, and I'm really honored to have you here, Karen DeGia. Some of you might know her late husband, Ralph DeGia of the War Resistance League, who, if you don't know Ralph DeGia, who passed some years ago, got to be one of the most important anarchists of the last century in my analysis. So don't come to the Anarchist Book Fair and leave without knowing who Ralph DeGia was. But even fewer people, I think, at least in this country, oddly and strangely, know about Karen. And her rather amazing work as a founder of a group called Children in Crisis, not inappropriate to the conversation we're having today about children, but Karen's work that I'm not going to say much about, because I hope you do. a little, or if you feel called to, about rescuing children here and in Europe primarily, but not exclusively, who have in some ways gone parentless because of war and crisis. So, Karen, welcome, and honored to be here. I was asked to do this a while ago, and I thought this was interesting and weird, because even though I know some of you and some of you know me about my own experiences in parenting and radicalism, and maybe radical parenting, it's not something I really talk or write a lot about. And so I said, okay, I write and talk a bit about education. I can talk about the nexus of those two things. And then, 3 weeks ago, my mom died. So I've spent the last 3 weeks thinking about that and this, and about at least spending a minute to talk about being parented as a part of the radical parenting gestalt. And then I thought about, from my own cultural, historic, weeny little bit religious tradition, I thought about Kaddish. And then you think about Kaddish, and you're a New York-born Jew boy, and you think about Allen Ginsberg, another great anarchist. And so I'm just going to say a few things that don't make sense, and then I'll get back into the talk again that makes a little more sense. It's only about 30 seconds, so. Yiskadav Yishkadash Shemir Abad. Ginsberg on Ginsberg said this. He said, I saw myself, my own mother, and my very nation trapped, desolate, and receiving decades of life while chanting Kaddish, the names of death, in many mind worlds, the self-seeking key to life found at our last self. And that was Allen Ginsberg writing about Kaddish and his own mother. Well, I was thinking about the parenting I received from my mom especially. I thought, okay, I turned out a radical, but I was not a red diaper baby. I was not brought up a radical, socialist, communist, anarchist, any of those things. But I did grow up at a time, I was a little boy at a time, when the images of Vietnam were strewn across the TV screen, unfiltered and uncensored, both by the powers that be, but also by my parents, who did censor things like Star Trek was, you know, kind of interesting, but a little weird. And you know, there were shows worse than Star Trek, I remember, that, you know, I really absolutely couldn't see. But the news, this horrific, brutal, violent news, was important. It was fundamental. And it was fundamentally important to me becoming who I was and who I am. And it was part of what I called, in writing her obituary, what I thought was my mom's natural-born pacifism. She wasn't an activist so much, but she evolved, living through the time she lived through, to an anti-war and anti-authoritarian politics that became central to my being. So then in thinking about that process, I thought, well, was that radical parenting? Well, not really, or not what I would have necessarily conceptualized it as 4 or 5 weeks ago even, and certainly not 4 or 5 years ago, or, okay, we won't say how old I am. But growing up, I didn't think of that as radical parenting at all. Because I wasn't a red diaper baby, like some of these kids that Vicky was talking about. But it was definitely, it wasn't anti-authoritarian parenting, but it was definitely non-authoritarian parenting. It was definitely parenting with an eye towards critical thinking and towards questioning everything, not just authority, questioning everything. And that, to me, has to be, on some rooted way, radical. Oh, we'll leave my mom and my parenting for a moment. I was asked to talk about education, and it seemed to me that part of the nexus, part of the connection between education, radical education, transformative education, and parenting has to first look at the role of education in society today. And then 2 days ago, one of the leading educational theorists in North America, Henry Giroux, just wrote a piece called "In Defense of Public School Teachers in a Time of Crisis." And I thought, okay, that was too timely not to like steal a bit from him. But it's not stealing if you cite him, right? So okay, here I go. Henry said, any movement for social change must put education and the rights of students and teachers at the forefront of our struggles. Teachers are more crucial in the struggle for democracy than security guards and the criminal justice system. Students deserve more than being trained to be ignorant and willing accomplices of the corporation and the empire. Teachers represent, or should, a valued resource and are one of the few groups left that can educate students in ways that enable them to resist the collective insanity that now threatens this country. So, conceptualizing education as part of the resistance movement, it seems to me, is fundamental. It's also a lost perspective, a lost art, a lost way of thinking about public education, public space, and education in general. But, you know, at an anarchist book fair in particular, it seems to me, I want to be sensitive to the ideas that say school is jail, but I also want to say not really, or not completely, or at least not entirely as a framework and as a rubric. Some schools have jail-like things about them, but school is not jail. And then I want to say, again, sensitive to the surroundings of being at an anarchist book fair, what about homeschooling? And now, to homeschooling, I want to say, maybe. Interesting, useful, important in some cases, but not universally the thing, the answer, the way to make the world right. So I want to get back to what Henry said and what I've experienced in my own professional life and in my own research and work about public schools. Public schools as a requirement and occasionally effed up. See, there's radical parenting, not like saying the whole thing because there are kids in the room. But, you know, public schooling as a required, though messed up, part of democracy and resistance. Okay. So now, the last piece of what I want to talk about, which is the entree points to look at schools as a place for resistance and democracy from a parent's point of view and from a community organizer's, radicals, anarchist, socialist, communist point of view. Because the spaces, like all of the political spaces around us, are closing and have been for most of my adult life. And it's a scary moment. It continues to get scarier, and I think it's another call for yet another series of actions we need to take. I think Jennifer's going to talk maybe a little bit about special education, the short bus. But I worked in special education 25 years ago. I started teaching in the New York City public school system. In special ed, and the book that has some of my experiences, this is the unabashed commercial plug. Although, by the way, there is a way of getting one for free. You have to give free things at an anarchist book fair. I'm not going to tell you the way, but you'll find out one of you will get a free one if you do the right thing, which I won't tell you what it is yet. But anyway, this is 25 years ago when I started out teaching in special education in Brooklyn. It was no coincidence that in all of New York City, there were no white public school students who were labeled severely emotionally handicapped. They were not. They were all black and Latino. All the whites were not severely, I guess. That was the thing. You had to be black to be severely emotionally handicapped. Two African-American deans served as the school father figure, and one distinguished gentleman, seen and treated as a community elder, ran a barbershop in the school that truly transmitted practical vocational skills to the boys, those all boys, who were ready to settle down. The rest of the school leadership, administration, union reps, department heads, and clinicians were all white, with a few, very few, young and talented black teachers, and me, at the bottom of the totem pole, causing trouble. The majority of the young men enrolled at Sterling High School were too disgusted or disconnected from the melting pot mythology that had never included them to buy into the education that some of us were trying to provide. Extremely street smart and savvy about interpersonal dynamics, these students could detect a sniffle from a 30-yard distance and knew if a teacher came in sick, unprepared, or simply too tired to give them the attention they craved and deserved. To preempt what must have been their 1900th disappointment, they caused havoc in the classroom before an unsuspecting teacher could cause boredom. Now, that was a far from ideal learning environment and space. And yet, it's amazing to me that 20 plus years later, special ed has gotten worse. That space has been decimated. And that school and many like it have been closed, not because they were bad and we need to make them better, but because they were too much. They were giving too much to those guys. Now we open up school on Rikers Island. Why have a school in the community? Just build more schools that are jails, literally, or in jails. A lot of this book talks about my 10 years as multicultural coordinator for the New York Alternative High Schools. I'll say it again, 10 years as multicultural coordinator for the New York Alternative High Schools. I say it twice because there's no such thing as multicultural education officially in the New York City public school system anymore. They did away with it. We don't need it. I mean, we've done that already, right? Multiculturalism. I mean, we're kind of multicultural. We don't need an explicit and thoughtful teacher training space to say to teachers, this is the way that you should look at race, gender, that you should look at sexuality, sexual orientation, and the range of possibilities, that you should look at your relationship with students and communities. No, multiculturalism was done away with in the late years of Giuliani and then even more so under Bloomberg. And then the other part of that sentence, alternative high schools. Alternative high schools in New York City used to take up about, it was one-sixth of the New York City public school system, largest publicly funded alternative space in the country. There were six different superintendencies, one for each borough in New York, and alternative schools. And at our height, one out of four high school students that successfully got a diploma in New York City spent some time in one of our schools. They were community-based. They were not parent-run, but they were generally run by and established by parents and teacher collaborations. Sometimes, the best of them, with intense student input. That's all but gone. It's been decimated. And though there is still such a thing called alternative high schools, the numbers are now, you can barely count them on two hands. There are less than 10 still existing. Now, there are some good small schools still, but the structure of having us together in one superintendency is gone because, after all, divided we fall. To replace all of that, to replace the guidance counselors, the grade advisors, the art and music teachers, faculty advisors of newspapers and clubs, parents now have this thing called ARIS, a rather hard-to-navigate computer system where if you have the right numbers to punch in, you can find something or other about your child's most recent test scores on the tests and on the standardized tests. And that's what we've got. That's what parents have gained with the loss of all those people, those humans that used to try to play some difference on a community basis. So, okay, that's a glum note, and I'm out of time. And this is the one thing I couldn't figure out. I had to, like, bring it back to some positive note. I will say this. It's not positive, but I'll say it. You know, Tomas talks about the Bay Area Child Care Collective, and the other side of what I do in the movement, you know, we have a local collective, and we always looked to you guys and said, oh, man, those guys really know how to do it well. So just know, you know, here in Radical New York, we're like, we don't even have that. The movement hasn't even built some of those child care models that I think the West Coast is a couple of steps ahead of us. And I guess the only punchy positive thing I thought to say came after Vicky said, and I really agree, that not only should kids make noise in the back, actually more noise would be better if you can pump up the volume a little bit, but also we don't mind kids who take books off the shelves and kind of rearrange them. I just, my closing remarks have got to be, as an author. Thank you. Yes. Actually, I have to say, I feel the same way. But the other thing is that, you know, as an author, especially, I know now more than I ever did, that's what books are for. books are not to be put on shelves. They're to be taken off shelves. I mean, if you read them, that's a plus. But if you don't, it's okay. Just sort of, you know, they are to be thrown around, rearranged, and taken off shelves.
Okay, so hi, I'm Jennifer Silverman, and I have a son who's turning 12 next month who was diagnosed with autism, and a four-year-old who is typically developing, what they call typically developing, and we're about the noisiest family you'll ever meet. So previously I had worked with Vicki in this collective of mothers called Mothers Alliance for Mutual Aid. It was originally Mothers Alliance for Militant Action, but somehow it kind of didn't fit. And I'm a co-editor of this anthology called My Baby Rides the Short Bus, The Unabashedly Human Experience of Raising Kids with Disabilities, which was published in October by PM Press. And also recently, I authored a chapter of an upcoming anthology about motherhood and madness, is the title. And it's based on a conference by the same name. And my chapter is about the caregiving burden on mothers and how it's disproportionate for mothers raising kids with special needs compared to fathers.
Is that true?
It is, statistically. So, like Matt, I was not a red diaper baby, but I was an activist starting from the age of 16, so that's over 20 years. And I did a lot of Green Party work later on, you know, college, early adulthood, but then in 2000, a couple of things happened that made me more radicalized. First was this crazy stolen election business, and at the same time, my son was being diagnosed, in the early stages of being diagnosed with autism. It actually took a year for us to get there. And so I found myself kind of completely freaked out, you know, at the world, but also I was in the system all of a sudden that I didn't want to be involved in. I had a social worker for my son. I had a registration. We lived in Albany at the time with, you know, the Albany County Department of whatever, early intervention, and I had these people coming into my apartment who were there, you know, presumably to help us, and they did to some degree, but it's really weird to spend your life trying to be out of the system, and then all of a sudden you're turning around the bookcase because you have the Black Flag of Anarchy on it, and you don't want these people to come in and think things about you that are true, but maybe not going to be helpful. Okay. I find it very hard for professionals to take me seriously. Especially when I was a younger parent, when I had pink hair, when I was 25, 26, and all this was going on. So that was kind of a weird switch. And at the same time, I was trying to do this activist organizing in Albany, but I didn't feel safe bringing my son, not only because of the autism, but just because he was two and little, and things didn't seem like they were set up for families at that time. And so I felt like I was compartmentalizing my life in these weird ways that I didn't like. I wasn't talking about what it was like to go through the diagnosis process. I was keeping the activism really separate, and they didn't meet for a few years. So then I moved to New York City in 2002, where I was from originally, and joined MAMA and started finding community support through there. And I started advocating and talking about my experience. And I started asking for things like community childcare for my son. And I got some mixed results. I had some really great experiences. I had some not great experiences where at one conference, the one-on-one person who was supposed to be watching him, and this is when he was five, I think, he was nonverbal. Starting from the age of three, he stopped speaking. And so I found him wandering by himself on this college campus, and it just was luck that I was outside at that moment and found him, because he could have wandered off, and I wouldn't have known what happened. So that was not a great experience. In things like this, the book fair, since I know the people who are organizing childcare, it's very easy for me to ask. But if I go to a new environment, unless I'm speaking somewhere, it's not something that's definitely guaranteed to me. And I still have to ask every single time. And when I ask, I'm always happy to give instructions and say exactly what we need and how to do it. And, you know, for the most part, again, because I've been presenting at these places, people have been receptive, but there are times where people don't call me back or don't email me, and I don't know if it's because either they didn't hear from me or they're just not interested in helping. So what I've been doing for the last few years is kind of channeling my activist work into this project the book that I mentioned earlier, which is an anthology of over 30 writers who felt marginalized in their experiences of raising kids with special needs, and they really weren't seeing themselves represented in the books that were out there. So we put out this call for submissions, and we, being myself and two of my friends who are a gay couple co-parenting four kids in Seattle, and we did this project over email and conference calls for really about 3 years from the time that we started doing our book proposal description till the time it was published. And so what I'm going to do is read you kind of an excerpt from the introduction. And sorry, it's dry. So this is from the foreword. Raising a child with a disability brings a whole new level of isolation to alternative parents who did not fit into the mainstream through circumstance, identity, or choice, and who carefully consider the implications of our parenting. Disability forces us to reach backwards towards the mainstream while moving us irrevocably outside of it. We might have been planning to put our children in small alternative schools before we knew they were disabled, and now, after the diagnosis, find ourselves fierce advocates of their inclusion in traditional classrooms. While we might have had home births planned, we may spend years in hospitals praying for the success of invasive medical procedures. While we might have fantasized about anarchist communes before our disabled babies entered our lives, we find ourselves lobbying the legislature for increases in funding to state bureaucracies. We, who had previously rejected the institutional structures of mainstream culture, or found ourselves on the margins to begin with, discovered that we are clinging to the slim hope that they will save us after all. We are remarkably absent from the public eye. When we are in the media, it's usually about a miracle cure that made some starlet's child more normal. Or there's the occasional story that spotlights a stereotypical American, white, middle-class, two-parent, heterosexual family, showing off the gifts of a savant or highlighting a feel-good donation made to a poor, struggling family with special needs. At worst, our families are objects of ridicule in alternative and mainstream press sources. As parents of differently abled children, we are often put on pedestals. People wonder in awe how we cope, or hand us platitudes about how we have landed in a different but wonderful country, where we simply need to dream new dreams for our special angel children. But when we're out in public, our special angel children are most often stared at and treated like enigmas. Our children are inconvenient, awkward, and difficult. Their parents, even those of us with a lot of tattoos, are usually struggling mightily to be less obtrusive. Those who wonder aloud how we do it are really just highlighting for themselves and us that they'll never have to. The truth is that our kids aren't angels. They're people with big challenges, and their challenges make our lives as parents incredibly complicated, messy, and sometimes heartbreaking, no matter how much we love them. As parents, we're already marginalized by politics, sexual orientation, gender, race, or ethnicity, parenting philosophy, or our own disabilities, economic status, blue hair, piercings, or something else that makes us unlike the camera-friendly special needs family America knows and adores. It can be harder to find support among other parents or be taken seriously by the teachers, therapists, and other professionals on whom we often have to rely to get the services our kids need. My Baby Writes the Short Book is meant as a partial antidote to the stories that misrepresent, ridicule, and objectify disabled kids and their parents. So that was co-written between me, Sarah, and Andrew, and my co-editors. And it really kind of sets the tone for the way that the book goes. And what Matt was mentioning about special education, there is a lot of that in there. I'm not going to go into it now because I don't have enough time. But we've been in the special education system in New York City for 8 years. And my experience has been much better than a lot of people's, because one of the advantages, or the only advantage, of having a child who's really severely involved is that people don't tell you no. So we've had a publicly funded private school placement for the whole time we've been in New York. And he's in that school. He can go there until he's 21. And he's in a class of 6 kids, 1 teacher, and 3 assistants. So it's a very managed class. And for us, that's the least restrictive environment. So my essay in the book is really more about the experience of raising a typically developing child after a child with a disability, and it's much less political than most of my writing is normally. But that was what we needed in the book, because those were kinds of experiences that were lacking after we got all the submissions together. But the way it's framed is around a conversation that somebody started with me at a recreation program that we used to use on Saturdays. And about a month or two after I finished writing the essay, that program was canceled for us, because some bureaucrat decided that the money that was funding that program would be better spent in another area. And that, to me, is kind of a symptom of the lack of community support that I find, is that I have to rely on these systems and programs that I'd rather not to, and then when it's gone, it's gone. You know, when I was at a workshop in Providence, I asked how many people in the room had experience with autism, and about half the people in the room raised their hands. But I don't see them stepping up and volunteering to make childcare inclusive. And, you know, right now we have a friend who is part of the anarchist activist community who was hired by the agency that runs my son's school, and that's fantastic. They're paying him $10 an hour. And that's totally not sustainable for anyone to live on around here. And, you know, the average is $10 to $14 an hour for childcare providers. And so I'm trusting my child's welfare, someone who can't tell me when something goes wrong, you know, I have to read the signs, with somebody who's getting paid so little. And half the time I hear stories that people don't show up, the workers, and I don't know that I blame them at the amount of money that they're earning. And I once sat down and figured out, they say that it takes $2 to $3 million to raise a person with challenges like my son's over the course of a lifetime. So I looked at my salary and I estimated how long I would have to work, and I would have to work for 416 years. But if we had more mutual aid and support, it wouldn't be about money. It would just be about the services existing. So on that note, I want to read a quote from the book that's from a woman named Mitzi Waltz, who's an anarchist academic living in England. She also writes for Fifth Estate and has a few books out of her own. And what she wrote was, "What we outsiders need is a good pair of army boots to kick down doors and kick recalcitrant service providers' asses, not patronizing platitudes or signposts to interventions affordable only by the top 10%. We also need to grow enough backbone to insist our own alternative communities get clued up and skilled up about disability, because in the end, the greatest hope for people with disabilities, our kids, is inclusion in truly accepting, nurturing communities that practice mutual aid on an everyday basis. We're not going to get that from the increasingly corporate education or medical systems, as necessary as some of what they offer may be at the moment. The best self-help doesn't come out of a book. It comes from real-world connections, skill sharing, and organizing to meet our own needs whenever possible." And so that brings me to my last point, which is that in order for movements or communities, and Vicky talked about this a little bit, but to be sustainable, they need to include all members. And be intergenerational, and whether that's, you know, what I'm talking about, providing community support and childcare, or even making sure that this space is accessible. I've never seen this room before, so I didn't know that there wasn't a ramp when I came in. But just to keep those things in mind when you're organizing. So I'm going to end there. And we can move on to questions.
I was wondering if anyone of you would be able to talk about how your anarchist has informed your specific parenting style, and conversely, to the areas in which you had to compromise on these beliefs.
That's tough.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, like I just said about my son's schooling, that's not a system I ever plan to be in.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and with my other son, I'm able to have more options. But I think what I've learned is that I need to adjust my expectations of what I want to do to what my child needs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether that winds up being a public school that he needs to go to or homeschooling or whatever it is, I don't know. I consider myself an anarchist to parents, mm-hmm. and an anarchist parent in that sense, but mm-hmm. I don't think that there's a specific dogma that I mm-hmm. kind of stick to. I mean, it's all different for all of us.
Okay.
Same thing with me and my daughter. We self-schooled my son through middle school, then he decided to go back to school, so we kind of have to work with that. Although, like, in theory, I think it would be wonderful that he was around, and my daughters mm-hmm. choose to go to middle school right now. So, and then getting involved in the court system is really hard to your anarchist principles of the practice there.
Well, I was kind of thinking in terms of like your specific interactions with your child, in terms of being mindful of like authority and the arbitrariness of it, but sometimes also like you have a very small child, you know, and sometimes you really do, really, the theory is like you really do need to just kind of go in and like get stuff done.
Duct tape.
You duct tape your kid?
Yeah, to the wall.
Oh, sure as hell. You know, that's a really complicated. I mean, you've got the answer to the question already. You said it, but you know, it's like all about rules, right? I mean, first of all, you know, labels. I'm not even sure I call myself an anarchist. Anarchist parent. That's really weird. From a radical parent, already is too complicated. So socialist, anarchist, it's like, okay, when we have to really make the rules strong, I'm more socialist. But, you know, the fact is, it goes both ways all the time. You know, and I think both of my kids, I have two kids, I didn't say it, 9 and 3, kind of underscored that in a major way. Yeah, every time I make another rule or feel like I have to enforce a rule, it's not just the making, it's the enforcing. That's the complicated thing. I go, oh, is this wrong? And with my 9-year-old, it's already been several years of conversations about whether it's wrong and what's wrong and, you know, rules and authority. But then the other thing is true also as well. It's like, you know, the idea of throwing out rules and saying, oh, there are no rules. Oh, no, there's a space for no rules. It's like I've learned more about spaces for no rules since having kids than I ever understood before then. It's like, oh, I can embrace no rules on a different level. And in fact, I have to, and it works in a way I didn't understand before I was a parent. So I think that goes too. I also adapted, and so I had to stop being arrested for a bunch of years, but that's another story.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's really good.
There's a question over there?
No.
Oh, okay, then.
I was just wondering if you could speak on the easiness or difficulty of instilling values in your kids that are like so contrary to what they're exposed to outside of the home. And just like that disparity in like what the messages they're receiving.
One of the things I found is that by bringing my kid to the things that I do, like when she was 1, like, I started doing talks about, like, prison issues, because I do a lot of work around, you know, incarcerated women and their resistance. And given that, like, I had kind of felt unsupported as, you know, like, the parent of a young child, and I wasn't necessarily seeing other parents with children being politically involved. Like, I saw them in, like, sort of the squatting scene and the movement, like, and I babysat for, like, parents of, like, you know, like, for kids in the squat scene before I became a parent, but I wasn't seeing them doing political work. I was like, I'm going to show my daughter that when she becomes a mother, if she becomes a mother, she doesn't have to give up, you know, like, her political self to become a mother. So I decided to bring my 1-year-old. She doesn't remember any of this. You know, but, so I started bringing her to these things. But the thing is, it's really interesting because by bringing her to these things and getting her involved and she'd hear what I said, even if she would really rather be over there, you know, like, drawing or, like, playing ball outside, is that she listens, you know, like, you know, whether she's, like, kind of, like, listening, like, half, you know, half-heartedly, or, like, she's really listening, she starts thinking about these things. So she's just like, wait, why do people go to prison for this? You know, what does that mean? You know, like, and she'll ask questions that are really incisive and questions that, you know, like, 25-year-olds might not think to ask. You know, like, it's kind of like, I don't want to say osmosis, but it's, like, this process of including them in what you're doing as opposed to, like, shunting them off to the corner all the time. On the other hand, it's also really important to also have childcare spaces so kids can be kids if they want to be kids, and the parents don't have to like go chasing out after them every time they're like, this sucks, I'm bored, you know, I'm going outside to like draw, you know, to draw chalk on the sidewalk, or, you know, I want to go play jump rope. So I think that like part of that was like, you know, like being able to include her in all these things and having her be able to like meet some really amazing people doing amazing work. And sometimes she'd be really interested in what they were doing, and sometimes she could care less. And it's sort of like letting her, I guess it's a kind of like unschooling without it actually being unschooling, where like basically she's learning from being around people, talking to them, having them include her in what they're doing as opposed to being like, why is your child talking to me? I'm doing serious political work, you know, type of thing. And, you know, so she'll ask questions and she'll form her own opinions about this. is. And my daughter is also 9, so like she hasn't hit that preteen rebellion phase where I'm gonna be like, you know, like she'll find it and she's gonna throw everything out the window, yeah. You know, but like
4 or 5 years, Vicky and I are gonna do a different workshop at this conference altogether.
Yes.
Much more gray hairs for her.
But you know, but just like to have that, you know, like sort of like that there for her, that information be there, you know, have people be open and sort of like have everybody sort of be her teachers when she wants them to be her teachers. You know, like has been like huge and amazing, and I can kind of see that difference when she has play dates with her, you know, friends who aren't necessarily from political families and like sort of their understanding of things, you know.
That hasn't come up so much for me yet, but I think what we're, because I was that kid, you know, in high school where my social studies teacher was calling me a communist, and, you know, and maybe at the time that was true, I don't know. But when we were talking about this recently at a workshop at the Left Forum, it occurred to me that kids today have the internet, which is not something that I had growing up. So when they're getting messages, you know, and they're feeling, if they do feel alienated from being like in a public school and hearing this thing that contradicts stuff at home, we were talking about support in a larger context. Like there's so many places they can go to kind of get back up from their peers now, you know, because of social networking, which is weird, but
I just wanted to ask kind of like along the same line as that, but maybe just even more specifically, I just like always have such a big concern about media exposure, and I just like, you know, from talking to some of my friends who were brought up like having no TV in the house, you know, you're not allowed to watch TV, and having that become like this rebellious kind of thing where then they really want to watch, and like how much can you control it to the point where, or like maybe it's just a matter of exposing them to media that's, you know, less oppressive in general, like giving them the option, like guidance in that respect, where you're not like, no, I don't want you to watch that show for such and such reason, but you know, they want to watch it anyway because you're just telling them no.
Well, I grew up not being able to watch TV. Not because my parents had any political leanings, but they were just like, no TV, period. You know, it was like, you know, like this authoritarian, like immigrant, you study and you read and you do not watch TV. You know, and I don't know if that like has affected me one way or the other.
Yes.
You know, but you know, like, so with my daughter, it's like she gets exposed to media, like, you know, like via the internet, and you know, she goes to her dad's house, and like, you know, like the TV is on. She goes to my mom's house, you know, like, and watches whatever like princess crap my mom will put on for her. So I don't think you can necessarily control what they watch, but what you can do is have a dialogue about it. So like, one of our running dialogues is like, how come all the Disney princesses are really skinny and up until recently white? You know, it's kind of like, how come none of those Disney princesses kind of look like you? You know, it's like, you know, like, why are they kind of like blonde, fair, and white, and like breasts that go like this, and you know, like, and it's one of those things, and it's a constant conversation. So I'm not saying like, no bad, although sometimes I do, you know, like, no bad, like, you know, I'll say like, you know, why is it that Barbie looks like that all the time? Where's fat Barbie? You know? Where's, you know, like, where's not like, you know, like, you know, that kind of Barbie? You know, why is the, you know, why is this like that? And sometimes she'll roll her eyes. You know, and but you know, it's a process. It's not like a cut and dry thing where you're like, this is this and that is why. But it's like a process, you know, and it's sort of like also teaching them to like think for themselves. So it's not like you think what I think. Like, and she'll be like, Mama, not everybody has to agree with you. So you know, it's a process of like raising people who can think critically. You know, not necessarily just like parroting whatever you say.
And we have we're on this A parenting list that Vicki moderates, and this comes up from time to time, and people come up with lists of books and movies that, you know, fit our ideals a little bit more so that there's a resource of things to go to. And you know, you can only watch My Neighbor Totoro so many times, but it's funny because I came home from the movies last night, I had a night out, and I found that my 4.5-year-old was up Googling, which I didn't know he could do, and he was Googling trains, and he found train videos on YouTube. So I'm kind of stunned, and I don't know where this is going. But if it's that kind of media, then I'm all for it, you know, because he wasn't, you know, hopefully he won't be Googling AK-47s or something, I don't know, by accident, but I feel like you can't get away from media at this point. You know, I know that there are some people, and I have friends who say that they're TV-free, but then I find out that they're watching Hulu. You know, so.
Well, what Vicky was just saying about raising kids that can think critically, and I think that a lot of that comes back to, like, the, I don't know, this is my only kid, and I think that, and we both, by virtue of our family relationship to each other, get isolated by that, and I think in terms of, when you say radical, you know, one of the causal problems is that we don't have culture, and so I think that one of the essential elements to radical parenting is making consistent relationships with other parents and other kids and spending a lot more time with each other. I think that that's essential so that you can have awesome times with your kids can have awesome times, you can have awesome times without your kids, and your kids can have awesome times without you. But I feel like this whole, like, constantly with your kid if neither of you are in an institution is really artificial and keeps the radical. Because at the end of the day, radical parenting means that you're breaking off enough space to continue your radical work, and you're producing someone who's going to do some radical work. You know, to me, in terms of we're in the trenches and there's some shit to get done. So, are people here from New York? Did you guys already do that?
There's a caucus after this. That someone, the organizer had a flood in her apartment. It's not going to be here. I don't know what it's going to turn into, but we're supposed to be meeting at 4:30.
Something.
At 4:15.
Yeah,
so stick around.
I'm sorry. What do you mean by we have no culture?
Oh, I'm sorry. All I meant was that we don't have a lot of the tenets that would describe a lot of traditional cultures. The ways in which we relate to each other are, and to ourselves and to our families, are without a lot of the accoutrements and dynamics that would describe cultures traditionally, or the majority of the cultures, in terms of the kind of relationships we have to people, ideas, and environment.
But I think, yes, thank you, I understand that better now. I mean, I think that's the opportunity, though, to create. I mean, that's the exciting thing. Because then we, you know, if the Senate looks a little close, but it's not quite, then it's just, okay, we're going to say. But if there's so little, and you're right, there's so little of describing the lives we're trying to lead, parents or non-parents, soon to be yet to be parents, allies of kids, whatever, former parents. But we create it, you know, we create it. And, you know, I saw the stack of free zines when I was trying to find the garden. And, you know, we can create stuff. I know we can. We do create stuff. So part of it is creating stuff that is not just, you know, readable by the 32-year-old folks who are black alone, but by, you know, 5-year-olds who are green. Just as an example.
My question was how, I guess when your kids get older, when you said like the teenage rebellion, just raising critically aware, critically engaged kids, and also having this mentality that shit has to get done, how do you engage in conversation with your kids and accept different opinions they may have? If you were talking about your kid wanting to go back into the public or private school system, how do you deal with that? And is it, like, when you care so much about this and you're so politically involved, how do you reconcile those sort of things?
When you figure that out, let me know. It's tough. No, it's the conversations are the best kind of. Like, my youngest daughter is really, really, she loves media, and so I engage with her on a regular basis. YouTube. She actually wants to audition for American Idol. She knows she can do it. So I'm like, yes. What song are you singing? Taylor Swift. I'm like, yes. So she knows all this stuff. She taught herself the guitar to actually play a song. So I mean, to me, I'm trying to, like, so although she's using that as a way into that kind of stuff, I mean, clearly she also has, through like osmosis or through the conversations we've had, recognized that she can sing Bikini Kill as well. But yet, what she chooses to do right now, and she sings it when I play and stuff like that. So, and you know, I've seen her essays when she writes them in school about like the how graffiti shouldn't be criminalized. I mean, that was a really interesting thing. Though she would never tell me that to my face, I think partly because she's individuating with me in a really profound way for her. Like, it's not, She refuses to come to Anna's book fairs now. My middle daughter's great. She's just like a totally different world. Like, she'll just do anything. She'll come, I'm like, great, whatever. And she has her own way of doing things. And my youngest daughter's really trying to separate and find her own space. And so I kind of feel like that, you know, I trust that she'll find a way to come to peace with that a little bit. And however she chooses to define herself as she gets older. But it's tough. I mean, I have to sit there and listen to Taylor Swift songs, which is very...
Yeah, don't give me a culture.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Oh, you're right.
Don't let me start saying...
Now I know what you mean. We have no culture whatsoever.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. But that's my experience. And my son is, you know, he's his own kind of person. And has made choices that, like, it was more difficult because I had to, like, talking about, like, if you make this choice and you get in trouble, like, the consequences that come are beyond me. And, like, I'm not going to be able to save you in that way. And he's like, all right, fine, I accept the choice. The consequence, then, of course, he gets busted, and then it's a tough choice, and he's got to deal with it. That's been a struggle. And because, also because, like, you can't stop them from doing what they want to do. Even though it's painful for you, it's painful for them, but that's where it's kind of like unconditional parenting, where it's like, I love you, and, you know, I'll do what I can to help you. But I've learned a lot. But in some ways, myself kind of letting go a little bit, like really wanting to create powerful, amazing people, yet they are indeed, but the choices that they make sometimes for themselves to have to deal with stuff that's difficult. You know, getting hit with, you know, having to pay $10,000 in fines and things like that. Oh. So. Yes, it's tough.
Other questions?
Yes.
Ooh. I didn't bring my big pad paper. If you guys are willing and interested in doing it, maybe we can just kind of shout out, not literally, some ideas about something you can take away from this that you can enact in your own community to be supportive of the families and kids around you. Is everyone okay with that?
Well, I think I'm definitely just going to be more aware after, like, being present with this conversation, just be more aware of, like, attending to those issues. Like, if I know I'm going to some conference or event, just maybe, like, somehow try to inquire if there's childcare, or maybe, like, offer myself, you know, volunteering, and, yeah, just putting myself out there to start building those relationships.
Something that you were saying was, that I thought was interesting, was just about how, like, previously really supportive communities were kind of considered exclusionary. Especially for women parents, and I guess that's, like, something I would like to, like, try and address in my community, like, the people that I know that children.
I think I'd like to re-extend the offer to babysit my friend's kids, specifically at, like, we do a normal two times a week a food serving, so, like, I haven't been around for a while, but I haven't offered to, like, watch their kids for them so they can cook instead of me cooking and them playing with their kids. Yeah. That's something I got.
Yeah,
I
support your idea. It's a good idea. I always play with kids, but also I think I remember being a little girl myself. I was a lot of times spending a lot of time watching my little brother and sister, and that would turn into me just, like, naturally watching the other children around. I stopped doing that so much, and people were always surprised when I did it, so I think it's something I want to do it again, which is just to kind of, like, assume that I should be playing with children when they're around me.
One thing I'm trying to get my friends to do is to, like, call me if they're, like, you know, if they're Friday or Saturday night, or if there's something that we all know is going on that's awesome. Call me if you're too tired and you're going in, because I want to, like, tuck my kid in on your couch and go out and goof off, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, getting that sort of, like, just passive support of being able to deliver your sleeping kid to a friend so that you can escape the house.
Amy, having done a fair bit of sort of childcare, I think explicitly political thing, I think there's no reason why your choices should be, like, be with your kid or be doing. big political stuff, like, you know, watch you go to the movies too, you know, or like you want to go like to the beach and like don't want to have your kid for a day, like that's the same thing. It's not like you should have a choice of like doing political work or watching your kid. You should have a choice to do a lot of things too. And I feel like the, you know, child care shouldn't just be like a yeah, okay, you're doing work, so I'll watch your kid for you while you're working. You know, you can take a break too. That's all right.
Yeah. For a while, we had a space in Philly, and we were sort of getting used to doing childcare ourselves in a daycare. And when we had the infrastructure, we don't anymore, but we were going to do just try to see how a radical daycare worked out. So when we accumulated that infrastructure, we were just going to do radical.
A few years ago, we did the Skillshare with People's Law Collective about what would happen if we were actually arrested at an event with our kids there. And it turned out that unless we managed to get our kids with a person and the arresting officer didn't notice that we had a child there, our kids would wind up in the system no matter what, even if we had like a signed notarized letter saying that they were supposed to be transferred to someone else's custody. Before that happened, they would actually be registered with ACS. And so that was really disturbing. Like, even if it was 30 seconds, they could still be put into that system. So that's why it's extra important that, like, we can't go to something that's, you know, unpermitted or potentially really arrestable. And that even extends, like, the RNC organizing. I was afraid to go out with my kid during that time because people were getting swept up in nets. I mean, what's going to happen?
I was going to say, I really appreciate what you were talking about, the need not only for childcare, but for childcare that specifically meets the needs of children with special needs. And I know that I personally have done some childcare with children with special needs, but it's never really played into my political work or my activist work just because most of the people in my community aren't parents and don't have children. Most of them don't have children with special needs, but I think it could be really helpful in our community to be more aware of that because it's something that really could... That could happen in our community, and I don't think we would know how to respond. So just to prepare ourselves and make sure that our community is actually welcoming and prepared to do it.
One other thing that I wanted to throw out there, which kind of goes with what Hambone was saying before he took off, is, you know, like, doing things with kids that, like, if you're going to go do something that you think a kid might enjoy, like my daughter, I don't ride a bike in this city because I'm scared to death I'm going to get hit by a Mack truck because I'm 5 feet and I can only ride low bikes. So, you know, like, when I've biked around, it's been so nerve-wracking that I just, you know, and her dad doesn't ride a bike. And when my daughter was 2, a friend who rode in critical mass all the time was like, why don't I take your daughter to critical mass? So we bought a bike seat and she put it on the back of her bike, and every month until the cop harassment got to be too much, they wanted critical mass, and it was, like, the most amazing thing for her to, like, you know, be, like, down, going down the street, you know, like, watching with all these other bikers, and it was an experience she never would have had my friend not stepped up and said, this is something that I think she would enjoy, let's do this together, you know, because, again, like, 2 non-biking parents in the city meant that, like, the child never would have been on a bike otherwise, you know, and now she loves bikes. She loves her bike, you know, she likes critical mass. She has, like, memories of, like, falling asleep on the ride and then waking up when everybody's in, like, Herald Square or Times Square, wherever, they're, like, all, like, holding their bikes over their heads and cheering. And she, like, wakes up and she's like, oh, yeah, everybody's holding their bikes up and cheering, you know? And this is an experience that, like, I didn't give her, you know? Her, you know, dad didn't give her. And it's something that, like, somebody was doing and was like, I can easily incorporate, you know, my friend's kid into this. I can, like, start building that relationship. You know, like, other friends have, like, taken her to, like, things like the Harry Potter movie. I could care less about Harry Potter, sorry. You know, but my daughter really likes Harry Potter. So, like, do I want to go to 3 hours of a freaking Harry Potter movie? No. But somebody else was like, I like Harry Potter. I want to go see the Harry Potter movie. I'll take your kid. You know, and again, it's like one of those things where it's like, if you're going to do something that you could just as easily take, you know, a kid in your community to, like, if you're going to go to a garden or, you know, go on a bike ride or go roller skating or go to see Harry Potter, you know, it's like, be like, hey, you know, do you think your kid would want to come, you know, because, and it gives the parents a little bit of a break, and again, it's not like they have to do political work, they could take a nap, They can, you know, take a bath. They can, like, stare at the ceiling. It's great. It's wonderful, you know? Mm-hmm. And it involves the kid, and it's like a relationship building thing.
Yeah, and another one of our mutual friends who happens to be very kid-friendly is a train hopper, so she's now entertaining my 4-year-old with stories about train hopping, which I'm hoping he'll wait a few years, because he's a little bit, you know, it's something that she knows is an interest of his, so she's really kind of, like, played into that, and, you know, we don't have that experience, my husband and I, so it's great that she can tell stories, tall tales.
Other suggestions?
I also just, like, kind of an idea popped into my head, just, like, collective, like, a child care collective, that's what he was talking about, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess I came in a little bit late, so I missed some of what he was saying, but just that idea is kind of, like, swimming around my mind.
They have an awesome model, the Bay Area Child Care Collective.
Mm-hmm.
And we were at the book fair last month, and their child care was fantastic, and the kids looked really engaged and happy and
mm-hmm.
active.
Now, there are a couple of progressive ones in New York, sort of, if you look carefully, but there's, you know, really, you know, you talk about scale, the city just does not have the kind of network. There was a time, I think, before my time as an activist, but, you know, where progressive events, radical events, had child care. That's just not the case anymore. It's not given at all in any of the different subsectors of the movement in New York City, I think in Philly and Jersey, you know, in our area.
There was one in Philly.
There was
child care.
Yeah.
Is it still?
I think this one might be a different iteration because it seems like it's kind of young, but there's really child care.
I mean, there are two I know of in New York.
Well, there's Ray Henry Sion.
Yeah.
But they do very specific child care for a specific group of parents, and sometimes they do events, but they're very, like, neighborhood based. That doesn't always work for all the rest of us. So.
Here's your hand up.
Yeah. I was just interested in how to plug in. Like, I don't know anybody really with kids that's outside of my, like, what I'm doing right now, but I'm interested in, like, you know, maybe becoming more accustomed to being with kids. It's been a while since, you know, and, like, so I don't really know necessarily know if I just, I'm sure the skills could be right, but, you know, I feel comfortable with those skills and feel comfortable with other people's children.
Yeah, I think also, like, it doesn't always have to be interacting directly with the kids. Sometimes it's just helping to organize a child care space so that you make sure that there are the right number of volunteers and that activities are planned. Like, if being with kids isn't, like, so much of a comfort for you. But also events like this where there is something already structured, it's good. Because also I think as parents, you know, we can't just send our kids out into the world and know that they'll be okay, especially for people we don't know, and particularly for me with a nonverbal kid. So sometimes it's also more comfortable for us to be in a public space where there's always, like, a ratio of more than one person, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that way everybody's more comfortable.
What's also, like, hugely helpful then, like, if there's, like, several kids in the room, that there's not, like, just, like, one
right
child care provider who's, like, there's an 18-month-old crawling that way, and, like, you know, an 8-year-old walking that way, and this kid needs to go to the bathroom, and, you know, like, it, like, relieves some of that pressure, and it's a way to get involved, I think, without necessarily having the whole onus on you, and, like, you know, like, just keeping in mind that you're there to do child care, you know, because one of the things I've noticed with newer child care volunteers, and I'm not pointing my finger at you, but I'm saying that, you know, is that sometimes they, like, end up talking with their friends instead of, like, paying attention to the kids. And so, like, it's kind of like, oh, so there's basically, like, you're making sure the kid isn't wandering into the street, but it's not, it's kind of like warehousing, you know. And so, like, to keep in mind that when you do child care, you're doing that, like, you know, unless you're, like, taking care of a friend's sleeping kid so they can go out into town for the night, you know, if the kid is, like, awake and active, like, you're there to, like, kind of make sure that you're engaging with the child and not sort of, like, talking to the other child care, adult child care provider, you know, about, like, their lives or whatever.
I think ratio is also important, just to reiterate. Like, I personally would never leave my child in a public child care situation unless there were two adults, unless I happen to know the person who's doing it intimately. Well, not intimately, but... Yeah. That's another story. Just really well enough that I know that that person is trustworthy. And, you know, it's... We try very hard to be trusting and not rely on, like, institutional structures like fingerprinting to make sure somebody isn't, you know, a convicted child molester, but at the same time, we a lot of times don't know who people are, so it's hard.
But we're giving him advice about how to do good or correct or appropriate child care work. But he's just asking where to find the kids. Which already, when I say it that way, makes it sound suspect. But, I mean, the fact is, I think there are two parts. You know, before we even get to some of these good pieces of advice that Jen and Vicky have given, one is, I say, whatever political organization, event that you're doing, not alone, but with someone else, you should experiment once or twice with putting on the flyer, child care provider. Maybe someone with a kid will come. That's the first thing, right? See if, in fact, maybe there's someone in your circles, if not central to your life, then, you know, the next level that has kids that may want to come.
I would just amend that to maybe say, like, contact us if you need childcare. Because
that's become a little more popular, because then you can have a heads up. But it's, you know, I guess, you know, we're talking broadly. I guess I'm talking broadly because you guys are talking more specifically. You know, I'd say, you know, the whole idea about interacting with kids, it's less, I mean, I was for years, many years, I worked with high school students, you know, as a profession, and was completely scared about 2- and 3-year-olds. And, you know, I found a collective that was interested in doing childcare, and partially they just kind of shoved me out there, and partially after a year or two I shoved back and said, I have no idea whether what I'm doing makes any sense. Kids kind of respond sort of, but yeah, I feel like I could do better. You know, but that's an evolution. That's a process. And I guess I'm hearing you really at the very, very beginning point saying, how do I start? And, you know, I feel like there is no lack of kids or parents in the left. But there is a lack, and there's huge lacks of spaces that are saying, child care provider if interested, you know, or however. If we put out that call, they will come.
Not to, like, put ABC and Rio on the spot, but a place like that, you know, community center, where sometimes people come in and offer, like, kids photography classes or something, that's a really good way to kind of, you know, if you have a skill to share, then that's a way to get to know parents and kids, but more in a community setting.
I think we're done.
May I say something to this group? It's been very interesting to be here, and I came to listen. So, but I would like to say one thing. I look across for a playground, and what disturbs me in the city is how many parents and child caretakers, or whatever they call themselves, nannies, are constantly on their cell phones. They do not interact with these children, whether it's mom or dad or the babysitter. These children are on their own, whether they're in a carriage or running around. And I find also, if you have babysitters, you have to sometimes take out the time and look, or have a friend look, because I see a lot of kids who never leave their carriage, because it's too much of a problem. So you have these nannies with their nanny friends sitting there and smoking and yapping, and the kid is like trying to get out of the stroller. And it's just really a sad thing to see that parents are constantly or other people on the phone. So anyway,
thank you.
I wanted to say I worked at a family center in Massachusetts for a long time, and I learned a tremendous amount about just, like, dealing with kids and, like, what it's all about. And the family center was just a place where parents would come and the kids would play together, and the parents would play with the kids, and then the parents would go in another room and do, like, workshops or discussions. And so there was, like, a English as a second language workshop, and there was a dad's workshop and a mom's workshop and a postpartum workshop, and every week the same people would get together. But I was just a student, actually randomly got paid to do it because of being in college, and the program was through college, but they kind of accepted anyone as a volunteer. You just had to go through the process of being checked, like your Corey check, and they also, like, interviewed you to see if you would actually be able to play with kids in a productive way. But I know the family centers are all over the place, and they're really great ways to just meet people, and also then when you have childcare at events, then you can tell these parents who already know, well, we have childcare, you should come to our event, which does work.
One of the things that Jen just reminded me I should talk about is I'm doing a zine series with China Martins, who did who's done the longest running parenting, subculture parenting, political parenting zine, The Future Generation, called Don't Leave Your Friends Behind. There's copies of it on the Rad Dad table, and it's not just geared towards parents, but it's geared towards people who don't have kids, you know, and how they can be allies in the lives of parents and kids from a variety of different perspectives, from like enabling them to be able to do political work to like enabling them to kind of like live more fully without having to rely on all these institutional systems that can oppress and destroy us. So there are copies of it on the Rad Dad table. There are issues 2 and 3 there. There's also a call for submissions if any of you want to like write about your experiences, like and ways and sharing ways that other people can, you know, participate in supporting parents and kids in the movement and like what that looks like, you know, like with you and your lives and with people.
And also Vicki and I both have books at the PM Press table, so I haven't seen the PM Press table yet because I came straight here, but
it's all by the stage.
Okay.
I have a problem. Yeah, it is a problem. So I have some books here, only a few. Mm-hmm. And the winning entry, I said one was going to be given away free for someone. It was the first person who made a comment who asked a question. And that person, I think, is not here. So there's a free book to someone who made a comment. You will have to fight. The rest can buy them.
Okay,
thank you very much.